And I was a bit of a smart ass. So the next year I was like, I'm going to be a fucking cheerleader. So I joined the cheer team.
Wow.
Yeah. And in Michigan, guys don't do that. So.
Everybody, welcome to the show. This is Coach Him Up. I'm joined, as always, with the Big 12 champion.
Big 12 champs. Here we go.
He got in last night at 4 a.m. because he was busy winning. Zach, tell us about your night.
So, yeah, we tipped off about 8 o'clock versus Iowa State Cyclones. Had a good game, pretty much dominated the whole time.
I watched it. You dominated the entire game.
Yeah, our kids did a great job just executing, and they worked so hard. It's really just cool to see them all put it together. And then that look on their face when we win, they realize like, okay, that's why we practice how we practice. That's why we're committed 7 days a week, 365. Like, it's a full-time job for these people.
Sure.
And so it's cool for them to see like, okay, this is a little bit of taste of what it feels like to win. And then we have the NCAA tournament in 2 weeks. So hopefully get that momentum rolling and win some games.
It's so awesome.
Yeah.
Well, congratulations.
Appreciate it.
And we're joined today by a good friend and a hell of a doctor, Dr. Colin Balarjan. Colin.
What's up, guys?
Maybe not everyone knows who you are. We know who you are.
Yeah.
But for the people who don't know who you are, can you give us a little bit about your background and how you ended up here with us today?
Yeah. So I'm a chiropractor, strength and conditioning coach. I'm at Collective right now, full-time coaching, doing metabolics and doing the chiropractic rehab thing. So where my whole story got started really is as a child, I was just like had way too much energy. So
relatable.
Yeah. Right. So we had this like regional, like fun track meet thing that you would do like a couple towns over. And I wasn't old enough to be in the track meet. So I would run the races on the infield and like pretend like I was in the race. And then they would give me candy bars like, good job, kid.
Wow.
Like, good for you. So that's like where everything kind of started. Through high school, I played like basketball, football, golf. I was a pole vaulter.
Jesus, dude.
Yeah.
So you're crazy.
Yeah. I kind of just did all the things. I
yeah.
Like focus on one thing. And I like, you guys sent me this like, hey, where'd you come from type of idea.
Yeah.
And I think what I realized, like I was reflecting a little bit, like when I was younger, I was driven by fun more than like training.
Yeah.
Like I listened to you guys' first podcast and like, Zach, you just loved training from a young age. And I realized that like, I was an 800 meter runner when I was a kid.
Ugh.
And I was like, I was pretty good. Right. But like, it got to the point where you had to start training.
Yeah.
And then I was like, fuck this. I'm out.
Yeah.
I'm going to go pole vault. That's way more fun
than
running 800s. So like, like, you know, I'm reflecting on this and like, maybe I'm making some changes right now. But anyway, so pole vaulter. And then my basketball coach, my junior year, cut my playing time and he wouldn't tell me why.
Okay.
And I was a bit of a smart ass. So the next year I was like, I'm going to be a fucking cheerleader. So I joined the cheer team.
Wow.
Yeah. And in Michigan, guys don't do that. So,
okay.
So I got made fun of a lot. And I was also an unfortunate looking kid. I looked like Napoleon Dynamite. I had like a red curly fro. I weighed 135 pounds.
Wow.
It was a bad situation.
Yeah.
The school that I was committed to just for academics, they were like, hey, you're a cheerleader. Come be a cheerleader on our team. So I, at Grand Valley State up in Michigan where I grew up, I was there for 3 years and I cheered on their team.
Nice. For people who don't understand what goes into competitive cheer, can you just give some background into how fucking hard it actually is? Yeah.
So if you're an athlete but not very good at field sports, this is where you end up because like it's super hard. It's really technical. It's a really tight knit team. But you have to be explosive because there's like a gymnastics component. There's a standing tumbling component. Then you have to be throwing girls up in the air. So there's like a strength component to this. Mm-hmm. And like your routines, albeit they're only 2 minutes long, they're wildly intense. So like the first time you run a routine full out, which is usually like 3 weeks before the national competition, a majority of the people are finding trash cans right after that 2 minutes because it's just like, I'm going to do 6 stunts, 4 tumbling passes, a couple basket tosses, all in 2 minutes. So like it's nonstop.
It's a CrossFit workout, basically.
Yeah.
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 Which is why I got into CrossFit at some point.
Wow. Nice. Okay. So, so continue.
Yeah. Yes. So I was at Grand Valley State for 3 years. And like I said, Michigan, like cheerleading is not a thing really, but in the South it is.
Right.
So we would go compete in Daytona, Florida in April. And that's where I saw Oklahoma State. They had a squad and they had placed second in nationals in Florida the 2 years prior. And I was like, that's where I'm going to go.
Nice.
So my junior year at Grand Valley State, my goal was to go to Oklahoma State. So I was practicing, training. Like I actually started liking training at that point because I had a goal to make a team. So I actually made Oklahoma State's team. I was like what we would call a stumbler. So I was better than average at tumbling and better than average at stunting, but not really great at either.
Got it. Swiss Army knife. So to
of
speak.
Some sort.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So my first year there, we got second at nationals again, getting ready for tryouts. I dislocated my elbow, tumbling.
Ow. Yeah,
not great. So I had Tommy John surgery on that guy. And they were like, hey, you're out for 13 months, but I only had 1 year left of school. So like that math didn't add up.
Yeah. Right?
So trained really hard. 3 months later, I was back. And my coach said, hey, if you want to be on the squad, you have to be able to do all of the same shit you could do last year, or else like it was a really competitive team to be on. And if you weren't going to be the same value you were the year prior, then like no hard feelings. We don't need you.
Yeah.
So like, you know, grit your teeth and do a bunch of stuff with an elbow that's like held together with three rolls of tape and some surgical pins.
Yeah.
So senior year at Oklahoma State, we actually won our national championship.
Wow.
So that was pretty sick. And then from there, went to chiropractic school in Dallas, was there for 3 years going through grad school. At that point, I was really focusing on like Eastern medicine type stuff. So like the acupuncture world and how that relates to musculoskeletal pain and function.
Mm-hmm.
So that's like a lot of my energy through school. Right after school, got into doing CrossFit myself, then quickly got into coaching CrossFit. I guess I should take a caveat. Like, my second year cheerleading in college, that's when I started coaching. So I was coaching gymnastics and cheerleading at that point, mostly like skill stuff. So I wasn't managing any teams. It was like, hey, you want to learn how to do a backflip? Cool. Come see me every Tuesday at 8 p.m. and we'll work on backflips. Same thing with like stunting. So I was just like a skills coach for 8 or 10 years in the cheerleading world.
Nice.
Got into CrossFit after chiropractic school, started coaching CrossFit because like I just like coaching groups of people. Like the skills gym would be classes of like anywhere from 12 to 18 athletes from not in the same class, obviously, but from 6 years old to like 20 years old. So we'd have like, I don't even know what my hands are, but I want to learn how to do a handstand. Mm-hmm. So like I'm trying out for a D1 college team. Can you teach me how to like make the team?
Wow.
So that was super fun. And you got to like teaching a kid to jump and flip upside down. Like, so like there's the physical aspect of it. There's the mental aspect of it. Like you're treating this entire athlete more than just like the physical side of it, right? Like it's a huge mental component in this sport. So jumping back, coach CrossFit for a bit, had a couple disc herniations in that. So I was like,
So can I just CrossFit. Like caveat there?
Yeah.
Like not a lot of people go from being a chiropractor to CrossFit.
Yeah.
You know, especially, yeah. Right. Yeah. I mean, now, obviously, yeah. Like, I don't think there's anything inherently wrong with CrossFit.
Right.
But like the typical.
It's a good business model, though.
Great business model. It's very self-fulfilling for you. But, you know, you take random people, you know, who haven't trained before and then get them into Olympic weightlifting, maybe perhaps before they're ready. I think that's where that whole thing with CrossFit comes from.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's the first time I've heard of a chiropractor choosing to do CrossFit.
Yeah. So like I said, cheerleading is there's lots of tasks that you have to do in your 2 minute routine. And if we were looking at one exercise modality that felt a lot like cheerleading that I was like incredibly passionate about still, CrossFit felt like cheerleading to me.
Nice. Right?
It was super high intense. There was a group that you're excited about training with. You probably failed a couple times a week at something, you know? So, I think it was the mental aspect of it that was really appealing to me. Also I was trying to start a business. So like you want to be around a bunch of people that are getting hurt. If you're trying to start a business, help people that are hurt. So like, just made sense at that point. Right. So like, yeah, to your point, like, I don't think there's anything inherently wrong with CrossFit.
No,
I think CrossFit
of course
did
not.
A bunch of really cool shit
yeah.
in the fitness space. Like in America, Olympic lifting wasn't really as cool as it is now.
Yeah. They probably made like working out and weightlifting actually cool.
Right. Yes.
Because before it was just like football players did this or like professional athletes.
Totally.
But it's like, no, regular person, you can teach them how to clean and jerk, snatch, back mm-hmm. squat. And like, it's cool. Like yeah. they yes. gamified it.
Yeah. And the conversation that I would have with patients that would come in, well, like, so in my world, they'd say like CrossFit hurt everybody. And you're like, well, was it CrossFit or was it a shitty deadlift?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like you could do a shitty deadlift at Lifetime or at Equinox, or you could do a shitty deadlift at CrossFit, but we're not going to say I was at Lifetime and I hurt my back. You're going to say I was at CrossFit and I hurt my back.
Right.
So now
right.
CrossFit gets this blanket term of
right.
hurts people.
But right, like, right, right.
No, it was the execution. Thing you did.
It was,
the,
yeah, it was, I mean, like, it was, yeah.
We could have a conversation about coaching and, you know, athlete to coach ratios and all that, whatever. But like, yeah, I don't think CrossFit's inherently bad.
Right.
But, I did hurt my back pretty good. That was, yeah, that was the third time I had a disc herniation in my lumbar spine. I had a couple of those in cheerleading. So like, yeah, I packed on some injuries. And then this is going to be another one where you're like, what the fuck? Cause I like, after I got hurt doing CrossFit, I like changed all of my movement patterns. I was like, well, I'm squatting like an asshole. I'm hinging like an asshole. Like the way that I think about my young athletic career is like, I said, I graduated high school at 135 pounds, but I had a whole lot of try hard in me.
Right? Yeah.
So I was doing a lot of shit that I probably wasn't strong enough for. And I was just getting it done at the cost of my discs.
Yeah. You're too young to know any better. And usually at that age, like you can recover from doing a bunch of bad sets of deadlift or squat.
Yep.
And if you're not around a coach who has a good eye of like, hey, that little hip hike you're doing, I know it's probably not bothering you at 23, but you keep doing that for 10 years. Like you're probably going to run into an issue.
Yeah. So I was like, all right, we got to learn how to move differently. And then I got into Olympic lifting.
Nice.
And if you know the Bergner squat cycle, 10 weeks of hell.
Yeah.
Like I ran Bergner back to back. And
is that similar to like Smolov?
Yeah.
The same kind of
issue. Front squat 10x3 on Monday.
Yeah.
Back squat 5x3 on Monday. And then you flip that on Wednesday.
So it makes sense if you got a bad squat, you're just hammering that over and over and over.
Yeah.
And that's like, the thing is like when you're young, like you don't know. Like you don't know till you get hurt. Right. And then you can either like change it or you just like keep getting hurt and you're like, weights hurts people.
Yeah. So I was like, I changed my squat and then I was like, well, if we're gonna make this like change the way I move, I gotta squat a lot then. Mm-hmm. So I ran Bergner 2 cycles in a row, which is essentially like 9 months of squatting heavy, and I haven't had a back episode since.
Wow.
So that was like,
what do you contribute that to? Were you doing anything besides like, I would like to think with your chiropractic background and everything, like you were doing some stuff, maybe some auxiliary stuff.
Yeah, for sure.
What kind of stuff were you doing compared to like when you were younger and you're like, my freaking back hurts?
Well, I had built lots of stiffness around my lumbar spine and around my tailbone. Not getting into the weeds a little bit, like there are degrees of freedom in parts of our body. So if there's like lots of joints and lots of bones in a space, it should probably move a lot, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it's harder to coordinate movement if you're letting all of those bones and joints move. So if you're trying to do maximal speed or maximal load things, you're going to lock the things down so you don't have as many pieces to coordinate. And that's just how I was moving. Like I had locked down my spine and my hips to the point where like I can get the task done, but like I can't be a human.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of the cost like we run into a lot with like training athletes. Like everyone gets, you think you need to get your squat, bench and deadlift up. And it's like to be good at squat, bench and deadlift, inherently you need to be stiff.
Right.
And then in locomotion, like if not you're good. Stiff and running, like that's when you get, ideal. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's like, how are you able to balance? Like you created this super stiff athlete that's really good at, you know, moving things up and down. What did you do to get into basically, like you said, like being a better human, being a better mover?
So that's where I think the nervous system does a really good job of perceiving change. It doesn't really do a great job of perceiving status, right? So like I had built a bunch of stiffness and like I didn't perceive it as stiffness because this is just how I move, right?
Understood.
So that's where I'll use like, people shit talk this all the time. I'll use like a lacrosse ball or something just so like it gives you the perception of like, oh, this is hella tight. And if I can make it a little bit tighter, now I can feel it relax. Mm-hmm. So once you start building the context of like, this is what different states of muscles feel like, then you can start chasing, like, and I know that internal cueing isn't hot, but like chasing some of those feelings in when you're trying to rebuild your squat, you're definitely like, what does my ass feel like when I'm sitting down into this?
Yeah.
How did I brace? What did I do around my spine? So like, if you can start building context around like, what do some of these joint complexes or muscles feel like in a very safe space, like lying on the floor with a lacrosse ball on your butt cheek, mm-hmm. then you can have a better opportunity to make a change while you're under load or moving with any sort of velocity. So it was just hours and hours and hours of like my yoga mat was in front of my computer. So I was watching like old school Kelly Starrett videos and I'm like,
dude, man,
doing like voodoo bands on my hips and lacrosse balls and
stretching. Did everyone here have a copy of Supple Leopard?
Have to. Yeah. What are some other people besides Kelly that you like dove into? Because you're with the older generation like us, like you didn't have that many resources like there are.
Dude, really like coming out of Cairo school.
Like Stu McGill or any of that stuff?
Yeah, a little bit of Stu. It was honestly because like, because Kelly was the physical therapist that was like still doing shit.
Yeah.
You know, like
he was still living in. Yeah.
Right. And then like you read a bunch of the other research from people that are like further in the chiropractic medical side of the camp. And it's like, don't do these things. So like none of that was like inherently attractive to me. Like I always wanted to be, my wife calls me Dr. Coach. Yeah. Right? Like I, when I'm working with somebody, like I'm thinking as a coach first. So like, I always want to be pushing the envelope and really doing as much as possible. So the really conservative approach to healthcare just doesn't jive with me.
Yeah, take 3 to 6 weeks off and then book another appointment.
Right, right. Yeah, exactly. Like I was talking to Tim about before this, like I'll tell my patients like, hey, we're going to poke the bear. We're going to like move into some discomfort because we have to like, we have to test the boundaries to know where the boundaries are. And I think that like some people just are a little quick to shy away from pain or discomfort.
Yeah.
When like a lot of the times pain is just like not really a problem.
Yep.
You know? Especially in that area. I think if anyone feels anything in their lower back, like people forget you have muscles in your lower back.
So right.
Like, yeah, I feel it in my lower back. And you're like, well, is it shooting pain down your leg? You're like, well,
yeah,
no.
Or
and
then like, just have a
that's
pump.
A muscle right yeah. there. Yeah. Yeah. That's your lumbar spine, pal.
So it was probably in the last like 5 years, I really started branching out into more of like probably like the newer wave of like thought process around training and biomechanics, like the Bill Hartmans and the like the David Grays and Jake Tura. Like I honestly, like as a clinician, I learn a lot from coaches.
Yeah.
Because coaches are the ones like who's getting more reps with athletes? Like who's gonna like how often does a clinician watch somebody squat?
Yeah.
Like I'm blessed because I work at Collective. So like if you come in and you're like, man, it hurts when I deadlift, I'm like, well, let's go deadlift.
Right.
Yeah, it's like
if you see what you're doing.
Busy day, like if you have 8 clients, I assume 1 an hour, it's probably a busy day. You're probably more than that, but like you only see 8 people squat.
Right.
And like you in a session, you got 30 guys in a group.
Yeah.
Right.
So you're seeing reps on reps on reps.
Yeah. Yeah. And we might not have the same language to explain like what did I see in that squat, mm-hmm. but I can bet you you've fixed more squats than most clinicians.
Yeah.
Right. You might not have the same language, you might not have like the same KPIs or whatever you're talking about, mm-hmm. but like when it comes to making a change in how a human moves, coaches are going to win hands down, in my opinion, at least.
Yeah.
As far as like reps and execution.
Can I dig into that a little bit? So, you know, you we're talking about, you have this expansive athletic background,
yeah,
expansive coaching background, all the way from, you know, basically what's gymnastics training from 5-year-olds to 20-year-olds, you get into training, into coaching CrossFit, mm-hmm. all the while you're a practicing chiropractor. Mm-hmm. As you learn and as you start to rebuild your own squat and improve your own athletic qualities, what are the changes in your philosophy mm-hmm. of how you treat, or let me back that up. How have your philosophies and understanding of how to meet people where they're at, how has that changed from when you first started practicing to today?
Mm-hmm. I think like when you're in school, you get really excited about all like the tricks you learn. Like I can pop your neck this way and I can stretch your hip flexor that way. And you're just really excited to like, get on my table and let me do my thing. But if you see like an old stiff guy walk in and he's like waddling around and his hip doesn't move and he's not bending his knee, like I'm not gonna change that on the table. right? Like I can do all of the best manual therapies in the world. But as soon as you stand up, unless we've addressed how you're moving through the world and we've had a conversation about how this is happening and we've mm-hmm. built different strategies, like I don't think it's going to change. So, Tim, you and I met because I was like, at one point in my career, it was after the pandemic. I opened an office 6 weeks before the pandemic. Really bad timing if you're in the business of touching people. So, you know, like a little while after that, I'm like, well, I'm going to shut this business down and I'm going to go be a coach because I honestly think that I can have as big an impact on people's health as a coach as I could as a clinician. So that's really where things started shifting and changing in understanding, like, if I want to have a long lasting impact and really empower this person, we need to talk about movement and we need to give them some tools around movement or around.
It's not all just happening on the table.
No, not at all.
So side story, I'm a manager at Lifetime Fitness and I'm on a regional sales call. So I was dead inside and I'm looking at resumes because almost certainly someone else has quit. I probably wasn't the best manager, but I see this resume. Cool, I was too cool. That was the problem.
Fun to hang out with.
I see this resume and it says Dr. Colin Balarjan. And I'm looking at all of this continued education this man has. He has his CSCS. He's a literal doctor. I called another friend who's a chiropractor. I said, I've got this resume here and I don't believe it.
Yeah, he sent it to the wrong place.
This is incorrect.
Screwed him over.
And he was like, look, just call him. So I call Colin and, you know, I'm going over his resume. He's telling me all this continued education he's done, his coaching experience, his experience as a clinician. And we got about 5 minutes into the conversation. I said, oh, let me ask you, man, what the hell's going on? Why are you applying here? And just what he said, I feel like, he said, I'm a little jaded. You know, my practice fell apart because of COVID. And honestly, I think I'm going to be able to have a greater impact on people as a coach than I'm going to be able to as a clinician. And immediately I was like, you're hired. I mean, I brought him in. We did the interview process. Trust me, he was hired. So anyway, continue. You start working for me, which is laughable. And what starts happening to your coaching lens?
Yeah. And that's where I really started. Like, you exposed me to like Jake Tura and David Gray. And that was really where, and we're going to get on this a little bit later, where the idea of like preserving athleticism became more of the goal in my mind than like keeping people from dying. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, if we're talking about all of the qualities that it takes to be a good athlete, like a lot of those qualities transfer over to being like a healthy human as well. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, if you slip in the ice and you like do this whole like try to catch yourself, like, have you sprinted? Have you done plyometrics? Are your soft tissues ready for that type of thing?
Yeah.
Right? Like, or if you get like old and like you're losing some muscle, like sit on a leg extension, get some quads rolling. Like, you're going to bend your knees and squat down to pick up your kid if you got some muscles to help you do it. Right. Yeah. So like looking at more of these like athletic type qualities that we can try to develop in the general population, but like being able to tell the story to them that like, this is important to you. Mm-hmm. And it's important to you because of these types of things, not because you want to have a big back squat or you want to be able to run really fast. It's because this is going to keep you from getting hurt when life shows up and asks you to do something that you're not prepared for.
So I got to see you firsthand, you know, kind of shift from maybe more clinically minded to more like, how can I meld these concepts I'm learning from people like Bill Hartman and David Gray, and shifting from clinician to doctor coach, like your wife calls you. Yeah. And it's been really awesome to watch, because I don't know that a lot of people in your position are willing to have the humility to admit as a clinician, like the things I'm doing on this table aren't making a lasting difference. Mm. And I remember you sharing that with me. Can you talk about what you were seeing and just sort of the struggle of treating people on a table and then having them come back and presenting the same things over and over again? And then where has actually being able to coach people in collaboration with what you do on the table, how that's moved the needle for your practice?
Yeah. So there's like some pretty common like joint ranges of motion that we look for on a table. We're like, hey, let's get your shoulder internally rotating or your hip internally rotating. And then we do all the things. We'd be like, hey, look at this. Your shoulder's super healthy. And then they get up and go work out. And they're like, yeah, but it still fucking hurts. Like, what are we doing? So being able to understand that, like, the table metrics aren't the same as like the life metrics, and being able to understand that, like, how we coordinate movement in real life is not at all how we were taught about anatomy and biomechanics in school. Yeah. Right? Like, we learned a super simplistic model about like concentric, eccentric, isometric, three planes of motion, all this stuff. And like, yeah, that works if somebody is standing right in front of you.
Right.
But if they're sprinting and turning directions, and if they're like moving up and down, or maybe they're in a stagger stance, all of that goes out the window. All of these muscle functions are very different, right? Yeah. Like, so if your model of movement is still based on Netter's anatomy book, like, you're not going to be getting the outcomes you want.
Yeah.
Right. So if you can have a really good understanding of like, what do the joints need to do to accomplish this task? How is that going to influence the loading patterns of these muscles in those joint positions and under these loads and at that velocity? What's the relative stiffness of the tissues need to be between muscle and tendon to make sure we don't have a problem showing up? Then you can be a little bit more of a sniper with what you're doing on the table. When you're like, all right, well, when you're doing your split squat, we'll get to this, like, your foot isn't moving, so that's making you load up your upstream this way. So if I can get this one joint in your foot to move, then I'll probably get your hip to feel different. Mm-hmm. So like, I'm not going to spend 30 minutes rubbing your hip flexor and trying to get your hip to rotate. I'm going to spend 5 minutes on your foot. I'm going to get that joint moving. I'm going to teach you how to feel that movement in your foot. And then we're going to put that into a compound movement and get you to feel how that changed how you recruited your entire limb. And that's really like how my practice has been evolving, like being able to understand what is the like the least minimal effective dose for time on table, and then get you onto the field or onto the floor or under a rack to be able to get you to experience how that change in on the table related to a change in your movement.
So what does it look like if you have a new patient that comes in? Are you like immediately to the table just to find like some grounds of where they're at originally? Or do you like to get them up and moving around, assuming they can?
Yeah. So I'm big on history. Like, I think, well, you guys know this, the body's adapting to everything we're doing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. So, if you were a soccer athlete from the age of 5 to the age of 20, I've got a sense of what your hips are going to do. I got a sense of what your feet look like because they've been in those cleats. We've got to understand. And like, then you could tell me about like, well, I had this injury here. So you might not know how they got the injury, but if you know they had an injury, you've got a pretty good idea of how they're going to move around that injury. Right. Mm-hmm. So like, if you can do a good history of like, what's your sporting background? What have you done a lot of? What kind of injuries have you had? How have you rehabbed those injuries? How do you feel about the rehab of those injuries? Then it's going to be really easy to hone in on like, all right, then I need to look at these qualities on the table. And then once I know how things move passively on the table, I've got an idea of how I would assume you would coordinate that standing in real life. And then I get to see, well, like, my assumption was you'd coordinate this, you'd solve this problem this X way. But you did it some really weird way. So
your best athletes. Yeah, your best athletes are your best compensators.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So like, knowing that they're going to solve the problem, and like, when you're working with like a professional athlete, it might take some digging to figure out how they solve the problem, because there might be layers of adaptations that they've built to make that.
Do you ever worry about with like a high level athlete, like, they're probably not going to have the same degrees of freedom as a normal person, just because they can do some athletic things that aren't normal to the normal person.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
So like, if, you know, I'm an NFL player come into you and I have an issue, like, is it one of those things where like, okay, they're super internally rotated. Is that something I'm really going to like, is everyone N of one, or who do you go back to?
I think that there is, you always have to have like a goal, right? There has to be an archetype that you're kind of chasing. But also understanding that like, a quality that makes you a good human would make you a bad football player.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
A quality that makes you a
it's good like football player. It's like health versus performance.
Right. Yeah. And, but so you have to have that conversation with them. You're like, all right, this is going to be the best way to rehab it if it was going to be Susie that goes grocery shopping on Tuesday and knits on Wednesday, right? But like, you're going to go get hit by big guys on Sunday. So like, yeah, we're going to do stiffness. This different, yeah, right? Like, so for example, like if you've got a real, like an offensive lineman, right? So those guys are heavy. Those guys are strong and yeah, they're pushing against another heavy, strong guy, right? If I see, like, I will never expect an NFL lineman's foot to have a good arch. I won't. Because like the likelihood of his foot being strong enough to be able to handle the force of him and the other guy pushing against each other is super slim. So like my goal is to not make that guy's foot look like my foot or look like your foot.
Right.
My goal is to get that guy's foot to do anything. Mm-hmm. Can it change shape? Can you make your foot look like you have an arch in any way, shape, or form for a moment? Sweet. Do you feel better? That's good enough. Like yeah, that's if that answers the question.
Totally.
That's
yeah,
the way I look at it.
So I feel like a lot of these athletes, like if you compare them to a normal person, you'd be like, well, that foot is too flat, or but it's like, well, right, that's a really good force producing foot.
Well, right. So to your point, I'm sure at least the people in this room have probably seen the photo of LeBron James's foot. We're not just sitting around looking at feet pictures, to be clear. Okay. I mean, you do kind of. Yeah. But, you know, Deion Sanders' feet, a lot of these these athletes whose feet are absolutely mangled. And, you know, you'll see a picture of it. And then almost certainly there's some movement guru who's like, well, if only his foot had more of this or that,
yeah,
then he would probably extend his playing career by 5 years. It's like he's the greatest basketball yeah, player of all time.
Contract in the first place.
Right. It's yeah, like maybe his foot looks like that and it's part of the reason the why thing, he's like, so great.
My question is, does his foot hurt?
Yeah.
Right? Like
totally. If there's no pain, then like, well, that's what the foot thing, like the athletes at the highest level, like their feet all look the same that are in these like stop start. Yep. You know, mm-hmm, acceleration, deceleration sports, like you need a super stiff mm-hmm foot. But like to your point is like, at what point is it too stiff that it's interfering with what we're trying to do because they have pain or whatever else.
Yeah.
And can I, so to that point, I want to use a real world example of this because Colin and I have worked together the past two seasons, NFL mm-hmm off seasons here at Collective. Colin works with Gen Pop all day, every day. He also works with some of the best athletes on the planet. And one of the athletes he worked with last year was DeAndre Swift, whose feet were a total shit show. And I watched Colin work with him multiple times a week. I don't want to go into what you did with him. I'll let you do that. But I was able to watch him progress. And then I was able to have conversations with Colin, the clinician, say, hey, here's what we're trying to accomplish. Let's bias these movements in his single leg squats, his hinges, his plyometrics. And then DeAndre Swift went on to have an injury-free Pro Bowl level year. Now, I'm not saying that's because of us, but I am saying that I watched his performance improve over the course of that offseason. So, Colin, can you talk about, tell us a little bit maybe about what was going on with his foot, because I know it's something that you see commonly.
Yeah.
Take us, you know, what did you see? What did you address? And what are the things that you saw happen?
Yeah. So Swift, his last season of the Lions, had a high ankle sprain that got misdiagnosed for like 4 weeks. So,
which is wild.
It wasn't a good situation. And then he had to try to like tough out the rest of the season and do what he could on that ankle. He also had an AC separation that year too. So it was a tough season for him. So Swift's one of those guys that does have a little bit of a flatter foot. Mm-hmm. So when I think about, there's 26 bones and 33 joints in the foot. Right. So that is your first opportunity to dissipate force or to change the way your whole lower extremity is going to interact with the ground. Right. So if his foot's pretty flat, like, is he dissipating force with his foot? Probably not. I can't pull over any further, sir. I've already pulled over. Right. Like, it's not going to happen. So first and foremost, it's like, how do you use your foot? Like, if your foot's super flat, where are you putting pressure in the foot? How are you pushing into the ground? And a lot of these twitchier athletes that need to change direction quickly, if they do have a flatter foot, they're just going to use an ice skate. They're going to use the outside edge of their foot. And that's just going to load very specific structures up their lower leg and into their thigh. So if we're talking about we need to have a really healthy lower leg to be able to support this high ankle sprain, we need to be loading as many tissues as possible. So we need to be using as much of the foot as possible. So I stole this one from David Gray, or learned it from him. It was like, for him, we're just going to take away parts of his foot to make him have to use the rest of it. So if this guy loves using his lateral edge, I'm going to take his heel off the ground. And if we take his heel off the ground, now he's only got his fifth toe.
Yeah.
So that's not going to work. His body's going to figure out how to solve it, right? You're going to have at least 2 points of contact. So now he's going to figure out how to get his first toe on the ground. And then we can give him some cues for like, okay, if we want to see an arch like appear in your foot and we want to be able to drive some muscular force through your foot, how high do we have to get your heel off the ground for that to happen? For him, it was pretty high initially to be able to create some of that. When we're talking about feet, the middle of your foot has to twist. The back half of your foot and the front half of your foot have to do opposite things for us to be able to get good force propulsion into the ground.
Okay.
So we had to get his heel pretty high to be able to see that change in the foot musculature. Then once we know that the foot is loading, I'll say better, maybe just differently,
yeah,
we're going to be recruiting different muscles of the lower leg. And if we've got a high ankle sprain, your tib posterior is kind of like redundant for that interossei ligament. So if we're not loading tib posterior well, then we're not going to be able to create any of that muscular bracing around the tissue that's already injured, right? So like we can use some musculature to protect some of his injury if we know what the shapes of the joints need to look like to be able to load those muscles.
Mm-hmm.
So first, it was really just like, how are we pushing into the ground with this foot?
Yeah.
Then once we can make sure that we can get you in different shin angles, different levels of knee flexion, different levels of hip flexion, and still have you maintain good pressure through your foot, now we can start adding load and velocity. So that's when we started like adding in plyometrics. And that's when like I passed them off to you because you're way better at plyometrics than me. So I was like, hey, Tim, we're looking for these. Like, I want his foot to be on the ground for this long because we're trying to express these types of qualities. I want him changing direction this way because it's going to make his foot achieve this type of shape, which is going to get the muscles in this type of length. And that's going to transfer to him having a healthier ankle structure. Mm-hmm. So like, it was really just a lot of this is kind of frustrating for these high level athletes at first, because it's like, hey, I'm going to have you slow way down and think about what your foot's doing.
Yeah.
And a lot of these guys are just so blessed that they've never had to do that
before. Well, they're more comfortable at higher speeds and higher velocities. So yeah, it's almost to keep them healthier, you have to reverse engineer it and make things slower, which is when everyone thinks of strength conditioning, they think like bigger, faster, stronger.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're trying to make a healthier athlete in the off season, slowing them down is probably going to be more advantageous than add more horsepower to the bad tires on the car.
I was listening to a Keith Barr podcast on Just Fly, and he was talking about like the sport stimulus versus the health stimulus, and like the slow isometrics or the slow loading, that's your health stimulus because that's going to pull you back from being wound super tight to be able to change direction. But
well, the cool thing about that is like the same exercise can be used as a health oriented exercise or a performance oriented exercise. Like just slowing down the tempo, you know, elevate the heel or float the heel, like it's inherently going to be slower or an unstable surface. And then you can take that same exercise and ramp up the horsepower. Mm-hmm. So that's cool.
Yeah.
You know what I heard a lot and what you were explaining was, you know, giving him more options than what he had. And, you know, something that I appreciate about your approach is you're not trying to fix anybody. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
The goal isn't to like save them, right?
Like he's broke.
Right. There's none of that communication happening.
Yeah.
You know, where it's like you're just giving them the information like, hey, here's what you're doing. Here's what we're going to do so that you can do more of this.
Mm-hmm.
Here's how that's going to go look. Now let's go do this. It's going to be kind of shitty for a couple of weeks and you're not going to have a great time doing it. But then on the back end, so can you talk about like what progress looked like for him?
Mm. It was slow at first and it was frustrating at first.
Like, usually is.
You know, like we're getting him in positions and he's shaking and he's like, why is this sore like this? Why can I only do this for 10 seconds? Why am I only using 10 pounds? Whatever. But it's one of those where like typically what I tell people is like, the first 2 weeks are going to be like frustrating because like we're essentially in skill acquisition land, right? Like I'm not going to give you a bunch of stuff that you're good at because what's that going to do for you?
Yeah,
absolutely nothing. Like, I'm going to expect you to fall over. I'm going to expect you to get frustrated. I'm going to expect your sets to be
short. Right. And not for the sake of making it difficult.
No.
Right.
Because if we look at these movements, they're simple as shit.
Yep.
Right. Like, hey, can you
stand theoretically
with your, can you stand with the front half of your foot on a weight plate and take your other foot off the ground and bend your knee 10 degrees?
Yeah.
And stand there. Most people can't.
Yeah.
And they get real pissed. Real pissed, right? So like, there's like the neural adaptation in the front end where like, all right, now I've got some context, now I've got some perception. And then he's a freak athlete. So then you can start loading him up pretty quickly.
Yeah.
Once you can teach these athletes, hey, this is what I want you to feel, this is how we should be completing this task, then you just let their genetics take over and you just be a smart coach.
Well, it's funny because it's like the same thing that gets them to a place where, you know, this idea that the best athletes are the best compensators ends up being, it's the double-edged sword. It's their best quality, frankly.
Their
ability, their ability to do that mm-hmm. is what makes them great. And then when it starts to bump up against pain or discomfort or where it leads them to trouble, the cool thing is that because they're so good at making those adaptations, inherently, when you give them new information, most of the time, they just adapt better than other people and they kind of figure it out. Right. And, you know, you can actually reap the benefits of that more quickly than with most people, which brings me to my next thing. So, you know,
can I jump in real quick?
Please go.
So I think what working with like the Swifts and the McColls and all those guys and taking that to the Gen Pop, what I think I learned was being able to talk about movement and pain on a continuum. Like that's when I learned to throw away right and wrong. Because you can't tell a professional athlete that he's doing it wrong.
It's a different strategy. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, who are you? Like,
yeah, what the fuck do you mean?
I can't tell Swift that he's doing something wrong. What? No. Yeah. So that's when you just say like, okay, that's how you're doing it.
Yep.
That's just how you're doing it.
Yep.
And if you do it that way, this is probably going to happen. Plain and simple. That's fine. Like there's no emotions about it. Well, you don't want that to happen anymore. So let's try to do it a different way.
Yeah.
Worst case scenario, now you've got a couple options.
Yep.
And I think like being able to have that conversation of like, one, people are more receptive to, hey, we're just going to teach you how to do this differently. Not, we're going to teach you how to do this right.
Yeah.
People are way more perceptive to that conversation than like
than making it about good or bad or right or wrong. Yeah.
So I think that was a really valuable lesson for me to learn as a clinician that I don't know that I would have if I had just stuck with Gen Pop forever, because you can tell Gen Pop like, well, you're sitting down wrong. Like even as dumb as that sounds, like,
yeah,
well,
they assume they are doing it wrong.
Right.
That's why they're seeking help from
right.
you.
Right. Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about what are the biggest differences you see in you know, the athletic populations and just Gen Pop? Like, what are the two things? What are the things that jump out to you the most?
Reluctance to be uncomfortable from the Gen Pop, right? So, like when you talk to an athlete and you're like, hey, we're going to make this change, inherently, they know we're going to work.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I'm probably going to get uncomfortable. It's going to take a while. But if you've got Gen Pop in you and you're like, well, your knees hurt for 10 years. Like, we're going to have to do, like, I don't know what the path to get there is going to be like for this scenario. I don't know what the path to get there is going to look like, but there's going to be periods where you're going to work really freaking hard.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of, I don't want to say a lot. There's a portion of Gen Pop patients that just aren't up for the work.
Yeah.
Just, they're just not. Like, and that's tough for me sometimes because I'm like, I don't get it.
Yeah.
Now, do you want to feel like crap or you want
to
feel good?
Yeah, you came to me for help.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm not saying I know everything, but I've read a lot and I've done a lot.
People just want the quick fix, the passive modality.
Yeah.
But
are you sure you can't just massage it for a little while with Dr. Colin?
Right. I'm like, no. Let's go get on the pendulum and get uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Because that's how we're going to get your hip.
Let's find the inside edge of your foot and smash out some pendulum spots.
Yes. Yeah. Like that's my flavor of treatment. I'm not, not everybody likes it. And it took me a while. Like I've been in the clinic for 11 years now. It took me a while to be okay with that. To just be like, okay, maybe my flavor doesn't work for them.
Right.
Like I'm going to encourage you to push into some discomfort.
Yeah.
You really like running. All right. And your knee hurts. Well, your knee's not good. Like, it's not injured. Nothing's torn.
Right.
if you love running, just run 2 miles. It might be sore for a little while afterwards, but like, it's not the end of the world. We're going to work on all the other stuff in the meantime. Mm-hmm. But if you really want to run, go for it.
And not have knee pain.
Right.
Or less of it.
Yeah. So like, I think that's the biggest thing, is just like having a realistic expectation of how long it takes for your body to change.
Yeah.
And to adapt to a new stimulus.
How do you create those realistic expectations? Because everyone wants like the quick fix. Like, I've seen you 3 times and my knee still hurts. Like, how do you help kind of set those realistic expectations?
I go on that continuum and I go to the very, very far end of it. So like, if somebody comes to me, we'll just go to the flat foot situation, right? They come to me for a flat foot and they've got plantar fasciitis. And in my opinion, if you've got a flat foot, we have to be able to figure out how to create a foot that looks like it has an arch, right? If we're talking about plantar fasciitis, we've got a flat foot, muscles don't shorten, or you've got a high arch and muscles don't lengthen. Muscles need to be able to do both. So let's just make sure they can do both. So if we're talking about this person with a flat foot, and like, inherently, I think we need more intrinsic foot strength, I'll just say, we need to make your foot a lot stronger. Let's just pretend that you squat 100 pounds today. I essentially need you to be able to squat 300 pounds. How long do you think it would take you to be able to squat 300 pounds if you can only squat 100 today? They're not going to say a week.
Yeah.
Like, even if they've never trained in their entire life, they understand that's going to take some time. So I usually just go to like some asinine example, and sure, they're like, okay, fine.
Makes sense.
Your Titan is going to take like 6 or 8.
Had 10 years of dysfunction, probably is not going to be fixed in 3 visits.
Yeah. And if you can create a, like, so what I like to do is say like, okay, so for the first week or two, we're going to be focusing on making sure that you can balance on your forefoot, right? Once you can balance on your forefoot for a minute, then we move into this. If you can create a path that makes sense as far as like, we're going to see function improve, then we're going to see strength improve, then we're going to see endurance improve, then we're going to try to tap into some velocity. And if you can tell that whole story to somebody, then they have something that they're looking forward to, and they kind of understand the process that they're in.
So your biggest thing is the education piece, the why behind, like, your thought processes.
Yeah.
Can we dive into, because I feel like every sport or gen pop, like, running is a big thing. Can you kind of deep dive, maybe do the poor man's version of what, you know, the foot, ankle, lower leg complex needs to do when you run, and some common dysfunctions, and what do you see in most people?
God, great question.
Yeah.
More of this is just more of my guilty wanting to learn.
Yeah. So, where do we start with this one? So,
like, what does the foot have to be able to do, ankle have to be able to do to someone who's going to be pain-free? And then maybe some common injuries with people who do run, such as, you know, shin splints, fifth met, knee tenderness, any of that kind of stuff.
So if we talk about, like, what a normal foot should be able to do, it should be able to pronate and it should be able to supinate, right? So a supination is going to be a high arch. We would also call a supinated foot a rigid lever. So when your foot is in supination, the outside edge or lateral edge of your foot, where your fifth toe is, your cuboid, which is a bone in your midfoot, and your calcaneus, which is your heel bone, they actually lock together. So there's a mechanism called the calcaneo-cuboid locking mechanism. So there's some people that
appropriate,
have, right? Yeah. So there's some people that would have an under-muscled foot. So their foot just does not accept the weight of their body. So they're going to rely on bony locks to be able to support their weight. And that's when we're gonna have some people that have some like fifth met stuff, because they're just landing on the outside edge of their foot all day long. The pronated foot is where we're dissipating force. So like, when you hit the ground's hitting you, and that vibratory force is gonna make it all the way up to your back. And we want a bunch of tissues to be able to slow that force down. So all of the joints in your foot are gonna do that. And then if the joints of your foot can move into pronation, we're going to start stretching muscles. And as muscles stretch, like, this is super interesting, at least in my mind, horses have interdigital muscles. So muscles between what would be fingers, but they don't have any fingers, right? What those muscles do is they slow down vibrations. So like, muscles do a lot more than produce force. Like in running, they're going to slow down vibrations. And the other thing they're going to do is living bones are not as stiff as dead bones. Right. So also, like, when you're pushing off, all of the musculature of your thigh compresses your bone and stiffens the bone as well. So it's going to create a little stiffness around the bony structures, and it's going to dissipate some of the vibratory forces, and it's just going to make you not hit the ground as hard. So if we're talking about like a foot that doesn't pronate, like,
can you show people who are watching kind of with your hand pronation?
Here we are. So if this is like, there we go. If this is the arch of my foot, like this would be supination. And if we, no, my wrist doesn't bend like that. And then pronation is your arch, like coming down into the ground. I almost brought a foot model, and then I like,
next
like,
time
that would be weird.
Okay, we can do more foot stuff.
Yeah.
You know, but keep going. This is excellent.
So if your foot is in that supinated foot shape and in that rigid lever, then that's when we're going to see, like I said, fifth met stuff. That's also might be when we see like medial tibial stress or stress reactions in the foot, or maybe even stress reactions in the hip. Because again, when you hit the ground is hitting you. And if you're not dissipating it, it's going to go somewhere. The force is going to go somewhere. The other thing that I think about, like the Achilles does do a 90 degree turn into the calcaneus. So when you're shortening your gastroxoleus complex, your heel bone should tilt in. When you're pronating your foot, your heel bone should tilt out. So if you're not getting that, it should be like 35 degrees one way, 15 degrees the other way. If you're not getting that 50 degrees of motion, then there's going to be a portion of your Achilles tendon that's not getting stretched and shortened. And if it's not getting stretched and shortened, then the fluid isn't getting brought in and pushed out.
Yeah, because tendons don't have any other method other than movement to get.
Right. And that's what I've been thinking about a lot lately, is just like in my training and in my rehab, I'm just thinking about moving fluid in this area. Like, can we just pump extracellular fluid, lymph, blood in and out of this region of the body?
Hell yeah. Just pumps everywhere.
Nerd. So
nerd alert.
Yeah. So that's where you get like stress reactions, fifth met. And I kind of talked about this earlier. If we talk about like a plantar fascial injury or pain, in our rigid supinated foot, all of those muscles are short. So every time you hit the ground, they're getting a really fast, really aggressive jerk, and they're not lengthening. So that's where your pain generation in the plantar surface could be more of that like myotendinous junction, or maybe even that like tendon bone junction. If we look at the flatter foot, then we've got like the plantar surface muscles that are in a very lengthened position. And now they're just working as hard as they can, but not accomplishing anything because the length force curve is like just not in their favor. Other things that can happen with like, you will never hear me say over pronation. I think that is an absolute junk term, because pronation is, if we talk about like what normal pronation is, it involves your shin, your rear foot, and your midfoot. And if you say over pronation,
like from where?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So like, I don't know what to do with that terminology. Yeah. But if you do have a foot that presents flat, it could be because you've lost arch height and your heel's in a good spot, or it could be because your heel is hypermobile and now your heel is sitting in an eversion.
And it's locked there.
This is what happens with a lot of our NFL players or our college players, is their heel gets put into eversion. So it looks like they have a flat foot, but if you go to palpate their midfoot, it's stiff as shit.
Mm-hmm.
So like, if you call them an overpronated foot, like that's not accurate.
Yeah.
It's not. So anyway, if we have like this overpronated foot, that's when we could have like some like aggressive medial loading. And that could be like your posterior shin splints. That could be some medial knee pain. That could be more like, I think of like more overcoming like muscular injuries. Yeah, those are like the big ones. And then like, if we think about like that, like anterior knee pain, that's where I think about like having a foot that can change shape, right? So if your foot's not changing shape when it hits the ground, what's going to be?
Force
like
has got to go somewhere.
It's going to go to your anterior knee. Cause then like, cause your foot's not slowing you down, so your quad's going to.
So would you say like a lot of people, cause we get this all the time, like patellar tendonitis, all that, is if I came into you and I'm like, hey, I got patellar tendonitis, been running a lot, all this stuff, is the first area you'd kind of address would be, let's find function and movement of that foot and then go up from there? Or do you go right to the spot?
I'm usually going to look at the foot.
Yeah.
Honestly, because like whether that was the primary cause or the secondary adaptation, right? Like they're going to try to walk around pain. So like if they've got a pretty nasty patellar tendinopathy, they're not going to want to bend their knee, right?
Yep.
So that means they're not going to pronate their foot.
Yep.
So whether their foot was healthy before they developed the tendinopathy or not, it's going to become stiff because they're dealing with the tendinopathy.
Yeah. And it becomes a chicken or the egg situation, right?
Right.
But either way, it doesn't really matter.
And like,
that's you end up having to address both.
Yeah. Right. And I kind of like, I probably use bad language with patients where I'm like, I don't really care what happened first. But we're going to fix both.
Yeah.
Right. Right. Like, right.
Ultimately, it doesn't matter.
Like, they're like, yeah, what do you mean you don't care?
Yeah.
So that's where, that's where I think there's like that line between, you know, everybody's like, we talk about like, it's, load management. Like everybody talks about load management. So when I'm thinking about like load management in general, and we've got an injured tissue, I'm thinking of like, how fast was that tissue loaded with how much force and how many cycles? And sometimes that's just, you did too much. Other times it's the way your body is coordinating that movement. Now that tissue is getting loaded too fast.
Mm-hmm.
So like, yeah, you could do all of the load management stuff, but if your foot doesn't move, when you go run, the load management's going to be off for your patellar tendon because it's getting hit hard every time.
So what are things, because I feel like this is common with most athletes and probably Gen Pop that works out a ton, is like that midfoot stiffness. Like what things do you do to help create some movement in that midfoot and then also in that heel that's obviously always like everted all the time?
Yeah. So if we've got a flat foot that's in the everted,
I feel like I see that a lot with high level athletes, like the heel's dumped out and the foot is flat.
Yeah. And this is where I need that foot model next time. So next time. There's your flexor hallucis longus tendon. So if we look at your medial ankle, there are, like, you can have tarsal tunnel just like you can have carpal tunnel in your foot and ankle. And in the tarsal tunnel, you have tib posterior tendon, you have flexor digitorum longus tendon, and you have flexor hallucis longus tendon and an artery and a nerve. The flexor hallucis longus tendon runs underneath a part of your calcaneus called your sustentaculum tali. And what that does is it actually holds your calcaneus into like a neutral slash inverted position. So that will give you better rear foot alignment. So that is like the mechanism I'm thinking about when I float somebody's heel. Like I'm floating your heel to make sure that you get force into your first ray or into your big toe and into the joint just like proximal to your big toe. Because if we can pressurize medial forefoot, we will be able to change how you stabilize rear foot. And that's where like with Swift, it was how much plantar flexion do I have to give you? How much force do I have to drive through flexor digitorum or flexor hallucis to be able to change calcaneal position? And that's where some things like putting a wedge underneath the toe. So like, yes, I've fulcrumed, like the whole foot is plantar flexed, but I've dorsiflexed the first toe. So now flexor hallucis longus is under more tension and that should make it easier to control the rear foot.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where like, that's where I really like the floating heel stuff. And that's when you, if you take somebody into like a floating heel hinge or like floating heel weight shifts, as soon as they go to push into the ground on that foot, you're going to see their strategy. Like when they get into the bottom of a hinge and their heels are floating, when they go to stand up from that hinge, 9 out of 10 people are going to dump to their little toe and then their heel's going to hit the ground or they're going to fall over. So it's a super obvious way to show them like, hey, this is your movement strategy, likely because of a strength issue. So this is how we're going to build the content. Like we're going to make you understand your strength issue.
So if athletes that have that same foot issue we were talking about that are in like 4 foot dominant positions or sport like basketball, usually on your 4 foot, cornerbacks, any sort of reactive athlete, are you pro, like let's keep them up on that 4 foot more when we load them, or do you do anything else, I guess, to combat that?
Yeah. So I've only worked with like maybe a dozen NFL guys. And I want to say that like, I don't want to like create generalizations, but there are like some of the twitchier guys that do have like stiff, high arched feet.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, and if we go back to that, like health stimulus versus performance stimulus, that's where, especially in the off season, I'm going to try to give them a bunch of stuff that they don't naturally find on the field. Right. Like, I think that like all of these guys are, they don't need help getting into extension.
Yeah.
They're going to find it. Right. He doesn't need help getting on his forefoot. He's going to get there.
Yeah.
But he needs to understand how to move with his heel on the ground.
Totally.
Can you get yourself into a positive shin angle with your heel down? Probably not. Mm-hmm. So like, I think we need to develop that quality. So like there might be a time where you get found, where you find yourself in that position on the field with your heel down and your shin positive, and we need to be strong there, and we need to be able to like have a strategy. So I guess it depends on if they're experiencing pain and what the rest of their training volume is. But typically I'm going to try to give them at least a dose of the opposite.
You know, one thing, like with that rigid foot, getting people into pronation and into internal rotation can be wonderful, just what the doctor ordered.
Yeah.
So can you talk about what is pronation, internal rotation? What does all of that look like, starting from the foot and moving up? And why is it important for athletic performance and outputs?
Yeah. If you look at the back of a foot, like just the back of the bones of a foot, and you see the heel bone, your tibia is like nearly entirely medial to your calcaneus. So in my mind, that means if you're going into a positive shin angle or your knee is going over top of your foot should pronate. Just because as your center of mass progresses past your heel, gravity and physics are going to make your foot come into the ground. If it doesn't, you did a bunch of squirrely shit around your lower leg to keep it from happening, right? If we talk about like normal joint mechanics, like your knee rotates like about 5 degrees, right?
So I think people don't realize like your knee rotates. It's not just
it's not just like a door hinge.
No, yeah. No. So
you better hope it's not.
Yeah, you're gonna get some arthritis if you do. So that's where like that pronation in your foot is gonna internally rotate your tibia, which is going to make your knee kind of rotate towards the medial surface of your knee. So if you're bending your knee and you're just rolling on the outside edge of your foot and you're not letting your foot pronate, now we're like compressing and shearing over a part of the joint rather than rotating and sliding across the joint. And that's where we can get like a weird meniscus injury. We can get like really like I don't think people have like tight IT bands. I think they've got rock solid vastus lateralis because they squat on the outside edge of their foot. That's what I think most people are dealing with.
Well, when you think about like a good back squat, we were saying before, it's like externally rotated, weight on your heels and outside of your feet. Like you're creating this screw type effect with your feet. And then when you're running, you're doing the opposite.
Right.
And so it's like I'm hammering all this stuff, getting really strong in these positions. Then I'm asking an athlete to sprint and jump, and you're going to use a different, hopefully a different strategy. Yeah, it's just kind of interesting when you train them to have a certain aspect adaptation, and then they're doing the exact opposite on the field.
So that like for those examples, that's when I'll like I do this 3 times a week. I pull up videos of Chinese Olympic lifters because when you watch them go through the sticky point in their squat, their knees are coming together every single time because normal joint mechanics at 90 degrees of hip flexion, you're biasing some internal rotation, which is going to give you transverse glute lengthening. Cause like, remember your glute does externally rotate and extend your hip and a little bit of abduction. If you're driving your knees out all the time, you're missing that transverse plane loading. So like you're leaving strength on the table. And when we look at our Chinese weightlifters, they're not trying to control their knee. So when they get to the sticky point, their knees come in a little bit, which stretches their glute, which gives them the force to be able to get out of the hole. Where like what we do is we just say like, hey, we're gonna drive these knees out to create a lot of tension in the glutes because that helps you keep your torso upright.
Right.
What would you tell to a coach that you see this all the time on Twitter, knees come in, they're like, valgus, they're gonna die. So what would you, obviously like too much, like if it's OD, like obviously not. But what are things that you look for that it's okay if that happens, or like different strategies of like maybe back squats not the best way to try to train that internal rotation?
Yeah. I think Greg Lehman, you guys know him?
Yeah.
I like his like movement optimism thing. Like if your movement makes me feel like I want to puke, we're probably going to talk about it. If it doesn't, then maybe we won't. Right. But in the knee valgus world, simply, if you've got your whole foot on the ground and your knee moved in a little bit, you're safe. Because there's going to be like when we're talking about like the idea of relative motions, like when you go into pronation in your foot pronates, then your tibia internally rotates, then your femur internally rotates. Things are moving at different speeds. That's really what we want to make sure is happening. Like things are moving at different speeds, so we're loading as many tissues as possible. So as long as your whole foot's on the ground, you're recruiting all of the musculature, and you're like, if your lateral foot comes off the ground and your knee is moving medial, you're moving through your knee.
Yeah.
You're moving through your medial knee. That is definitely happening. if your whole foot is on the ground and your knee is moving medially, you're probably rotating through the joint and you're probably safe. As long as like there's not a glaring asymmetry and a wild hip hike happening at the same time, I'm probably going to be okay with it.
So if you had to like say like, okay, what's the difference between internal rotation and valgus?
If we see like a distinct slowdown and shift while valgus is happening, I'll probably do something about it. Unless we're at like 98% of our max and you're like, weird shit's going to happen when you're lifting that heavy. Like,
yeah,
in my opinion,
it's right?
Like,
yeah,
you're under maximal load. Like the worst of you is going to come out and hopefully we're not doing maximal load all the time. Yeah. Right. But like, if there is, if there's a big slowdown, a big shift and a little bit of valgus, then I'm probably going to address it. But if it's like mostly symmetrical, their speed is pretty consistent, then I'm probably like, good job.
So for me and my, with my athletes, I actually, if I get an athlete and they've been working, they've been squatting a certain way, I can notice it immediately if the cues they've heard their whole life are chest up, butt back, weight on your heels.
Yeah.
And nine times out of 10, what I do is when I see that, I encourage them to just use your whole foot.
Mm-hmm.
I've found that's the only cue I need. And what almost immediately happens is instead of this huge externally rotated, expanded, however you want to say it, squat, which is typically more hip dominant, now they start using their entire foot. They start to get some medial translation of the knee, some actual internal rotation, and things start to feel better and they start to feel their quads. And then you do that.
My back doesn't hurt as much.
My back doesn't hurt anymore. And hey, you know what? I'm actually getting a pump in my quads for the first time and not my low back.
Mm-hmm.
So can you talk about, and I know that, that this is something that we've talked about a lot being nerds. Can you talk about how biasing, using the whole foot and maybe like different loading strategies, what are ways that you can encourage an athlete to get a little more internal rotation in their squat or their single leg movements?
Yeah. So I've been playing with the idea of, this is going to sound like a Bill Hartman thing, like not using tension to create stability, but using pressure. So like using pressure and position to find the ability to produce force. So like if I'm walking out a squat, like I'm going to walk the squat out, I'm going to have like slightly relaxed knees and I'm just going to like kind of bounce underneath that weight. Even if I've got like a few hundred pounds on my back, I'm going to bounce. I'm going to say like, is there any like pinch point in my body when I bounce? Is there, do I feel this bounce go all the way down into my feet? Like, is my whole body accepting this weight right now? And then I'm like, sweet. Now I'm going to take a little breath in and I'm just going to sit down. And I think like a lot of us learned how to weightlift either in group fitness or in high school. And we use those cheap cues of like butt back, chest up, knees out, because it, in general, it keeps people safe.
Yeah.
In general,
it's a strategy.
It's a good strategy.
Safe, yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Is it going to work all the time? No. If you do that for 15 years, is shit going to start feeling weird? Yeah.
Yep.
So like, I think that's I've had a lot of success with some people that have had chronic back pain by just saying like, hey, let your feet be feet and like, don't try to control your back as much.
Mm-hmm.
And then they go work out and they're like, holy shit, man. Like,
are there different cues you give to the feet? Like, are you like a drive your big toe into the ground or a 3 point of contact or like, what are things you look
for? So I'll tell people like, we're always going to look for 3 points of contact, but the pressure on those 3 points is going to change depending on what we're doing. So like, I like putting people in a slouchy front foot elevated split squat.
Glorious.
The quad pump you will feel if you're like a knee out kind of
guy. So slouchy, you mean
like I'm rounding my back. I'm hanging almost like over
Jefferson curl.
Yeah, I like that. I mean, I think to digress a little bit, think everything we're taught is like big chest. And then if you look at people running in locomotion, like you're not running like
right.
this, or you're not fast right. if you do. So it's like, I actually took this from Corey, who I work with. Like, we'll do a lot of the auxiliary stuff like that, where it's more of like a rounded upper back. And it makes sense for movement. Like, guys are going to get in these positions in the games. And if we're always training like this, the second they have to, you know, compress and expand, they're going to get hurt.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So I think that slouchy, like if you make sure somebody's not using their back.
And they're not loading, just to preface, we don't have 315 on our back.
God, no.
Yeah.
I've just, got like,
you know, people at home, no, like they said, this guy's a slouchy back.
Chiropractors are dumb. I knew it. Anyway, yeah. So, no, like you might have a 20-pound weight vest on.
Yeah.
You might have 30 pounds on each hand or something.
You're being smart.
Yeah. You're being smart. Because, like, really, this is, again, one of those health stimulus or context stimulus, or like, I'm trying to get you to feel your body do this differently.
So, this would be a good, like, if I have a big back squat planned, you might have this in the warm up.
Yeah.
Or something like that before we actually
gonna
get your ready quad for that.
A lot. You're going to pump a bunch of blood into your knee.
I just want to make sure people aren't using that for their A1 block.
Yeah. So like I play around with the idea of like, I'm going to give you a set or two of that before and then go rip shit on your back squat, get super stiff, get your feet all weird, and then go do another set of that. So you're not leaving the gym with all that neural tone.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like let's calm you back down. So your body is still being a body and not a weightlifter. But yeah, so like I like the idea of getting people out of their back so they can feel their foot. Cause like if you'll like stress shield your foot with your back. Like if you like
back's pretty strong. So
yeah. Sense. So if you go chest up and knees out, like knee out is lateral edge foot.
Yep.
No other way around it. Right. So then you're not going to feel your whole foot. But if I let you slouch, it's going to be hard to drive your knee out if you're slouching. So your foot's just going to kind of flatten out. And then I'm going to have you just stay over top of that foot and get as deep as you can. And we'll see what happens. Like, how much do you hate this? But then when we go off of that drill, this is probably more with like a novice squatter. I'll have them like, now we know what your foot can feel like if you're really using your foot to push into the ground. Now I'm going to have you go do a back squat.
And carry that skill.
Yeah. I'm going to have you do like the rip-a-toe 10-second squat. And I want you to like, what are your feet doing? Like your feet are your limiter on your squat depth right now. As soon as your feet start turning out, we're going to stop and we're going to see if we can adjust where the load is. Do we need to put the load in front of you? Do we need to put the load at your waist? Like how can we change the load to where you can get into more flexion and not have to bias external rotation through your foot?
Something that we had talked about prior to you coming on was this concept of prescriptive fitness.
Yeah.
And you know, just from our short conversation, I'm really excited to hear what that means and what that is. So, prescriptive fitness, what does that mean, and why is that important?
Yeah. So, I've been in the clinic for like 11 years, and I talk about pain all the time, which is like a little, it's depressing, guys, for being honest. So like VO2 max, like we'll just use that as the example in this prescriptive fitness idea. Like VO2 max used to be like college athletes, endurance people, like you have to be like highest of high performance to like even care about your VO2 max. Now we're like, actually, it's not all that useful in performance, but if we want to know how healthy you are, it's actually pretty useful because it's like a singular metric that looks at cardio, vascular, respiratory, and body composition. And it's still classically thought of as performance. So like how many other performance metrics can we kind of break apart and understand what they mean for physiology? So like VO2 max, like what's your max aerobic power? How explosive are you? How long can you go at a low intensity? Like all of these things that we used to think were just for athletes, like plyometrics, for instance, like how long can you bounce on your forefoot before your heels start hitting the ground? Like, I think all of these qualities are going to just make you a more robust human for when life comes and asks you to do something. So I think the idea of using performance or athletic metrics to be able to understand where a person's weak spots are and then just train them like an athlete.
Yeah.
It's more fun for the client. It's more fun for the coach, and it's probably going to translate to better outcomes in the long term. Like there's so much more to being a healthy human than having enough lean tissue. And I think most of the time when somebody hires a personal trainer or a strength and conditioning coach, it's like, no, you hired a strength coach.
Yeah.
Right. Like we didn't really do anything other than lift weights. And I think there's just like, and that's when it goes back to like what we were talking about earlier of some people are just like shy away from hard work, right? Like I coached CrossFit for 5 years. The one workout that nobody showed up to ever was the 5K. right?
Running sucks.
Nobody showed up to the 5K. Now I'm doing metabolic testing on a bunch of people. And the way I do metabolic testing, if we do like a resting metabolic rate on somebody, we can see like, what's your RMR? How many calories do you burn in a day if you just laid in bed all day? The other thing that my machine will tell us is, are you burning more carbohydrates or more fat in that resting state? Because like whatever you're burning, whether it carbs or fat, you're going to create CO2 as a byproduct. Carbs are going to create CO2 a lot faster. That's how my machine registers this. When we look at, like, I've tested a lot of CrossFit athletes. At rest, we want to see people burning 75% fat. It's a more stable fuel source. You're going to have stable energy throughout the day. If you're burning more carbohydrates, we're going to see spikes in blood glucose. You only have enough sugar to last a couple hours, so that's going to crash. Then you're going to get this cortisol dump. Then your blood sugar is going to go up, and it's going to go too high. And then you're going to get this insulin dump. And then you have this seesaw all day long. I do metabolic testing on CrossFit athletes. Regularly, we see them burning 80% carbs at rest, because the only way they exercise is redlining.
Well, to make sense, you build this high octane system, so you can't use oil to,
right,
like long burning fuel. Like, you need jet fuel.
Exactly.
And yeah, I think that like the cardio thing, like health drives performance. So if you're not using your aerobic system, like, it's going to come back to bite you in performance, probably for your anaerobic activities.
Totally. Because that's where you're going to get your, that's where you're going to reduce your recovery time between sets and between days. That's when you're, it's, yeah, it's huge. And like, when we talk about VO2 max as a metric, like, you don't, in my opinion, you don't develop a VO2 max by doing VO2 max efforts. Like, I've been describing VO2 max like as a washcloth, right? Like, a washcloth is your oxygen carrying capacity. The water is the amount of oxygen you can get in to the water, into your body. How well can you wring out the washcloth? Right. So the two things that we're testing in a VO2 max test are, how well can you wring out the washcloth, and how big is your washcloth? Because some people, like, I've done tests where people just aren't in good enough shape to wring out their washcloth. They're going to quit. Other people, their VO2 max is low because they just don't have a big enough washcloth.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we found people that are anemic, like their VO2 max was like 27. I'm like, this doesn't make sense to me. Like, what's going on? And I look at the data, and I'm like, they don't have hemoglobin. They were anemic. So like, we got them to a doctor, got their like supplements up, and like their VO2 max came up pretty quickly. So when we're looking at like more athletic type qualities, you get to have a more complete picture of the human in front of you, I think. And that's what's exciting to me, is just understanding how we can make like an entertaining, because I think that's important. Fun is important to some degree, right?
Yes.
How can we make like a fun stimulus that's going to impact as many systems as possible for the people we're working with?
Yeah. We're coming up on time, but we've got some segments here we want to do with you, some rapid fire stuff.
Got it.
So the first one here, I'll let you go.
Ooh, I actually like this question a lot. What is a good thing that's happening in or to your industry?
I don't even qualify myself as a chiropractor, honestly. Like,
yeah,
it at the gym, we talk about like, what are we supposed to call you, Colin? Because like, I don't think a chiropractor is it. So I'm just going to talk about like
your coach chiropractor
rehab in general.
Yeah.
Like, I like that we're at least the communities that I run in, right? We're seeing a lot of people pushing their clients and patients more, and we're doing like less band external rotation, mm-hmm, scrunch the towel with your toes.
Like, you're these bird dogs.
Yeah. We're like, we're getting people sweaty. We're getting people uncomfortable. I think that is a really, really good change if we want to have like complete outcomes in rehab settings.
What is something that you don't love? Give me a rant.
I'm going to piggyback that same one. I don't love when people think that, a barbell is the only way. So like, I've worked with a handful of clients that you've got a lumbar disc. I've been dogmatic about everything, right? I've been doing this for a while. So I've been dogmatic about something, and then I'm like, no, that's dumb. And then I changed my mind, right? Cause you learn, you grow, you figure things out. Like, there was one point in my life where I was like, all I need is a barbell, and I'm good to go.
You're the dangerous 25-year-old.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that like, when we were talking about healthy 25-year-olds, yeah, use a barbell. But when we're in the world of like pain and injury, there's a lot more nuance to it. And we have a lot more tools at our disposal. Why wouldn't we use them? Right. Like Tim and I have talked about this plenty of times, like the pendulum,
God,
the
so hack good. Squat.
Like there's so many great machines that like people just don't use. It might be ignorance. It might be, I don't know, some dogmatic position on it, but like, there are
machines are inferior to barbells,
right? There are so many tools out there. And I think that like, if you can appreciate the tools and you can appreciate the problem in front of you, you just got to get creative and come up with like the best solution for the person that you're working with.
So let's say there's an 18-year-old, they get into college and they want to, you know, be a chiropractor, someone like you that's, you know, a chiropractor and a coach, kind of encompasses everything. What are three things they can start doing now to put themselves in a great position to be you someday?
I don't know why you'd want to be me. be curious. Don't just think that you'll learn from your industry. Like I've learned from physical therapists, from strength and conditioning coaches, from psychologists, like you're ultimately treating the person in front of you. So like be broad with your curiosity. So you can, there might be some random thing you read in a psychology book 4 years ago that like really applies to what this person's going through right now. And you're a chiropractor, but like, who else are they going to hear that from? Mm-hmm. Like they're in your room that day. So I think being curious is one, finding a good mentor to just like ask questions, have accountability with, to like kind of guide you and point you in directions. And then just hopefully you're passionate about it. Like, I think passion is huge because like, I go on vacation and I take textbooks with me. Like I read textbooks about feet on the beach. It's fucking weird. But like that now people come to see me from all over the place because like I know some stuff about feet. So I think like be curious, find a mentor, just keep going.
To that point, I've never told you this, but I'm gonna tell you now.
Tight.
When I describe you to people, when I refer them to you, this is something to the effect I said, the reason I love Colin is because it means more to him. And I tell people that when I have a problem, I don't want someone who kind of cares about it. I want someone who has an unhealthy relationship with it. I want someone who loses sleep and, just like you said, takes foot textbooks to the beach. And people usually laugh and I go, no, really, he cares more. And, you know, being passionate about it, being obsessed, you know, frankly, it's one of your best qualities. You know, it's what's made you such a damn good coach, man. So just know that, I'm not kidding. I've told at least 8 people that. So, and ironically, I think they've all ended up working with you. Yeah. Okay. Last thing, unsolicited advice. So you can give advice. It can be to anyone about anything. Yeah. It doesn't have to be about feet or anything we've talked about today. Yeah. If you had some advice, you're walking past an old woman in Kroger and you're like, excuse me, ma'am. And you just laid some advice on her. What would be some advice? And it could be about feet. It could be about anything you want. Give us some advice. Give the people some advice, dude.
Oh, God. So the first thing that came to mind when you sent me this was like, just be curious.
Yeah.
Don't be a dick in like every situation. Right. Like in your career, in the people you're meeting, like we interact with a lot of people, right? A lot of people. And sometimes when you're like, as a coach, as a clinician, sometimes you meet somebody for the first time and you're like, I don't like you.
Yeah. Fuck this guy.
I don't. But like our snap judgments are usually wrong.
Yeah.
Right. There's going to be something. So like, give it a chance, lean in and just be curious. Because you'll probably be surprised, and if not, you'll learn something. In the worst case, you just like leave and you're like, okay, that guy really was an asshole.
Right.
Just be curious.
Colin, where can people find you? Where can they learn more about you?
I've got a sporadically active Instagram, Dr. Colin Balarjan. I've got a couple videos up on YouTube, more about feet, Colin Balarjan on YouTube. And
can you spell that out for the people less spelling inclined?
Less spelling inclined. There's way too many letters. C-O-L-I-N, not colon, Colin. Balarjan, B-A-I-L-L-A-R-G-E-O-N. Nice. It means cereal maker.
Cereal maker.
Cereal maker.
What?
It's French Canadian.
French Canadian.
We fed the community. That's what that means.
Nice.
That was important 400 years ago. Not so much now.
Important, but in a different way.
Yeah, in a different way. In a different way. Yeah. And I work primarily out of Collective South. So you don't have to be a member to see me as a client, but that's where you can find me.
And if people are interested in working with you virtually, what's the best way to contact you?
Shoot me a DM on the IGs.
Nice.
Yes.
Sliding Collins DMs, slide baby.
Do it.
Eat first.
Eat first.
All right. We appreciate y'all. Thanks for hanging out with us. We'll see you next time.